A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode of Everything Under the Sun is sponsored by NHTSA. A child's body temperature rises 3 to 5 times faster than an adult's, and leaving a child in a hot vehicle can lead to their death very quickly. Tragically, in 2020, 24 children died of pediatric vehicular heat stroke, and many of these incidents occurred when parents or caregivers simply forgot the child was in the car. Please set yourself reminders on your cell phone or place something you'll need in the back seat so you don't forget your child. Always look for your baby before you lock. From AccuWeather.com, this is Everything Under the Sun. It's our weekly podcast with stories, interviews, and information which combine the expertise of our great AccuWeather meteorologists along with the knowledge of a family of experts and friends that we invite to come back often, all with a focus on weather and climate-related subjects in an effort to weatherproof your life. We are in the midst of our series of episodes dedicated to the spring of 2021. This is episode 9 in that series, and we are already halfway through the final month of meteorological spring, and we're at the very beginning of solar summer. So we've got lots to talk about on this week in EUTS. We will see the first rays of focus segment focus on billions of bugs that will be coming to the surface after 17 years below ground. The largest brood of the bunch and all of the cyclical cicadas are about to take over the sounds and sights of early summer in the Northeast. We'll get you all you need to know about this amazing thing that actually has a pretty good weather tie-in. Then we'll head across the pond to the UK and check in with Chief Executive of the Royal Meteorological Society, Dr. Liz Bentley, getting an update on the submissions for this year's Weather Photographer of the Year contest in association with AccuWeather. The submission deadline's coming up at the end of June. We'll get you all the details again so you can check your camera, your digital archives, even your mobile device for a new division opening up this year. Can't wait to catch up with Liz here later on this episode. And then in our final segment, I bugged Bill Dagher to join me in our final segment to talk about our normal weather for the weekend and week beyond segment. Certainly the northern tier of our country is trying to rebound from some very chilly and damp weather of late. We'll see how that progression goes and everything else as you navigate your way through this upcoming weekend and a week beyond. Friends, I'm your host, AccuWeather meteorologist Dean DeVore, and it is time to talk about everything under the sun. Over the next couple of months, billions of cicadas will emerge in the northeastern part of the United States after spending the last 17 years below ground. Over the span of the next few weeks, they will molt, mate, and make the next batch of Brood X that will go underground again, only to come back to us here above ground in 2038. It's that something that we only see, 3 to 5 times in our lifetimes for most people, especially who live in the friendly confines of the Northeast. As you will find out, there are other broods with not as many members that come out at other times. So while you may experience other 17-year cicada cycles, this one is the granddaddy of them all. The National Pest Management Association is a nonprofit trade association founded in 1933 and represents the interests of the professional pest management industry and pest control professionals in the United States. It's Chief Entomologist and Vice President of Technical and Regulatory Affairs is Dr. Jim Fredericks, who earned his PhD in Entomology and Wildlife Ecology from the University of Delaware. It's been a long while since he's been on with the program with us, and we are happy to welcome Jim back to Everything Under the Sun. So it's got to be an exciting time for people that deal with insects and bugs as we get ready now for what I hear is we call it Brood X. You know, we have generations that have Roman numerals now. Now, I guess the cicadas have different designations. And it was interesting as I was going through, I've been learning a lot here the last couple of weeks about the different kinds of cicadas. Now, we get cicadas every year. Towards the end of the summer, those are what we call, seasonal cicadas that emerge at the end of the summer, basically here where we live in the mid-Atlantic. But this is a different cicada. This is a cicada that goes away. It's a periodic cicada, and they come out when the soil temperatures reach 64 degrees. I think that's the magic number. And so they actually come out earlier in the year. So we're already seeing the emergence in some of the mid-Atlantic states and areas south of the Mason-Dixon line and out west. I think a lot of us in the interior northeast are waiting probably a couple of more weeks. But exciting time is it happens once every 17 years, and it's going to be quite an emergence, it looks like, over the next couple of weeks.
You're right. And this is really an exciting time for entomologists and insect or bug enthusiasts all over the East Coast, because this brood 10 cicada. So the different periodical cicadas are grouped by Roman numerals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was lots of talk, I don't know, two decades ago about Generation X, the slacker generation. I'm part of that group. And we've gone the way of the millennials and Gen Z, I guess. But brood 10 will be emerging in, across 15 states in the along the East Coast and in the parts of the Midwest as well. And this is one of the periodical cicada broods that covers a number of major metropolitan areas. So lots of people will be experiencing these cicadas that will be emerging over the next couple of weeks. We will literally see billions of cicadas emerge across these states, and they will begin to make quite a racket as they sing together and chorus to find mates.
Jim, the cicadas at the end of the year that we're typically used to, it's noisy, but it has a rhythm to it. They kind of increase, they get to a point, and then they decrease. The earlier cicadas, this brood is a 17-year brood, but apparently, I didn't realize this, there's actually a cycle of some broods that are only 13 years, right? So there's a different time span in some of those, but their song is a little different, and it's really loud, and it's really intense. I have a brother who lives in Alexandria, and I remember last time around with this brood, he said it sounded like a jet engine in his backyard for hours and hours and hours. It just was hard to sleep, think, or do anything here at the height of this.
So only the males sing, and they're calling for mates, and they sing in unison. They're trying to be attractive to the females, but there are just so many of these periodical cicadas at any one time, and scientists have measured the volume of this sound, and they say that it can reach up to 100 decibels. And so,
wow,
that's some loud noise.
That's as loud as Beaver Stadium in a big football game, or even, you know, as when we got a big play going on. So yeah, that's quite incredible.
And when you compare that to the annual cicadas that we hear and see every autumn, well, not autumn, I guess August, they call them the dog day cicada.
And it's right, because they come out towards the latter part of August. To me, it's almost a sad song. For me, it's almost like summer's coming to an end when I hear those, right?
Summer's coming to an end. School's about to start. But it's part of the soundtrack of our summer. And you'll hear them you hear them kind of drone and on and off throughout the day. But these periodical cicadas that will be emerging now, and then we'll be singing over the next couple of weeks, right up probably through June and maybe the beginning of July. There's just a lot more cicadas singing at any one time. And so that's the difference.
We are talking with Dr. Jim Fredericks, chief entomologist for NPMA. And let's talk a bit about the life cycle. So what we see is the emergence, and here is the emergence after they've been in the larva state for the 16, 17 years underground. And the first thing they do is they're trying to get up out of the ground when they're emerging, get up onto the side of a tree or up into a tree usually. And that's when they kind of split their shell, they come out, and then that's when they start the racket. Is that how that goes here in the next week?
That's right. You know, you ought to get your junior entomologist merit back.
Brother, I've been an amateur entomologist. I've always liked bugs and insects. But yeah, that's the I've loved to watch this stuff. But yeah, that it is pretty cool.
You describe it so well. And so these cicadas have been underground for the last 17 years. These cicadas hatched from eggs 17 years ago. So the high school graduating class this year, they were infants when these cicadas hatched. The iPhone didn't exist when these cicadas hatched. The last episode of Friends aired the same year that these cicadas hatched. So it's just like
You're making me feel old, Jim. Stop.
You wrap your head around this. They've been underground. And what they've been doing is they haven't been dormant. They haven't been sleeping. They've been feeding and growing. And so what nymph cicada, so the immature state of the cicada, their true bugs are called nymphs. These nymphs will feed on tree roots. And so they're actually feeding on the xylem, which is the water conducting elements within the tree roots. And they grow very slowly and they go through a...
Do they look like kind of a grub, what I would call a grub, like kind of like a little kind of fat wormy thing? Or what do they look like at that stage?
No, they aren't kind of a worm form. And if it was, that would be in a group of the insects that would have complete metamorphosis.
And gotcha. Right.
Grub or a worm form instead are true bugs. And so they look not so different from the adults, except that they don't have wings.
Wings, right. They don't need them underground, so why have them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, when you take a close look, you'll see these nymphs as they crawl up, because when they crawl up out of the ground after 17 years, when that soil temperature reaches 64 degrees and we have a nice warm rain, they'll emerge from the ground through holes that they open up that are about dime-sized holes. You see them climb up the trunk of a tree and they'll leave behind that nymphal shell. As you described it, that nymphal exoskeleton will split down its back.
Right down the middle. Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
And the adult cicada will emerge. And so that nymphal shell that you see on the tree is essentially what that nymph has looked like for the past 17 years, albeit in successively smaller stages from when they first hatched.
Do they molt a little bit when they're underground? So they go through a couple of those exoskeletons before they come up?
They will. Yeah. And just like all insects. So when you're carrying your skeleton on the outside of your body, there's only so much room to grow. And so insects, like all arthropods, are going to go through a molt. And each one of these stages, they'll emerge from that old skeleton. And then their new exoskeleton is relatively pliable and soft. And so they'll puff up, they'll stretch that skeleton out, and then they'll essentially grow into their skeleton until they have to molt again into that next successively larger stage.
So now they've climbed up the tree, the split. Now we're into the final form of the cicada. This has wings. When I see at least the seasonal ones, there is some flying, but it seems like to me they're really only flying out of necessity at that point. The wings aren't something they use a lot. Is the these cyclical ones, do they have a little bit of a different pattern in that, or is it kind of the same where they're basically coming up, they get into that final form, they're mating, they're using their mating call to find someone to mate with? And how long does that process take? How long are they emerged and into this final form? And in that period, is it a couple of days where they're alive in that state and trying to mate and reproduce?
They'll actually be in that kind of chorusing, singing, looking for mate stage for a couple of weeks. So maybe 6 weeks. And you're right. You don't think of them as just buzzing around. They will use their wings for locomotion. So they're going to move from one place to another using their wings. But they can sometimes be kind of clumsy. Mm. After all, you know, they've been living underground in the dark for 17 years.
Right.
Got this new pair of wings.
Right.
You know, there's not a whole lot of practice. And so, they'll sometimes be a little bit clumsy. But what they'll do is when they come up out of the ground, they emerge from that nymphal shell, their exoskeleton hardens up, their wings harden up, and then they'll fly up into the treetops. And that's where all the action happens.
The ones that we see on the trunk and in the lower branches, they're just kind of starting the process, right? All the good stuff's going on up top.
Typically, yes. And so they'll go up and join this, chorus of males, and they'll be calling for females. The female, if she likes the song of a particular male, she'll come over and actually, she doesn't make any sounds. She doesn't make sound in the same way the males do, but she'll come over and she'll flutter her wings. She'll flutter her wings. And that's the indication that she's interested in that particular male. And so they use their wings a little bit in that courtship process as well. But for the most part, not great flyers. And so don't be surprised if you're driving down the road and some cicadas bounce off your windshield or you're out in the woods and you're observing these cicadas and some of them might, land on you or bounce off of you. They're not interested in us at all. We just
right. They're not biting insects. They don't bite at all. They're just it's kind of scary, and it's because they're more freaked out by getting on you than as you are of them. And it's sometimes it's just because they're big and clumsy, like you said. It's disconcerting mostly when you have a real up close and personal interaction, I think, with a cicada. And then once they pick their mate, and they go through the courtship and the mating process, how much longer then are they alive in that form? And then what happens next? Does the female start her trek down to the ground and start burrowing into the ground? How's that work?
So this is cool. This is actually a really amazing part of this whole process. The females will lay their eggs in the trees.
Ah.
And they actually will use what's called an ovipositor, right? It's essentially a device at the tail end of their abdomen, and they'll slice into young green twigs at the end of a tree branch. And into that slice, she'll insert eggs. A single female will lay up to 500 eggs over the course of a couple of weeks.
Just from one male? I mean, that's all from the one male?
She would essentially need, a single male.
Right.
And then when those eggs hatch, they fall from the trees to the ground.
Ah.
And then find their way burrow into the ground. So they might, find their way into a crack in the ground, or, find some way to start to begin their trek and burrow down and begin that 17-year underground life cycle. So
a nap. Well, it's not really a nap. Like you said, I think that's the misconception is that they're napping, but they're not. They're actually down there feeding and growing over those 17 years.
That's kind of the thing that is really pretty amazing, that they're not especially active, right? They're not, running around. They're slow moving. It's relatively cold. So where they're feeding, it's, as a cold-blooded animal, insects rely on their outside temperature to kind of give them the ability to move quickly or to be more active. So in warmer temperatures, typically cold-blooded animals are going to be more active, but temperatures are relatively cool, but stable even through the winter. And so their life process, their growth is slow. And over the course of those 17 years, they're feeding, eating, and then growing and eventually emerging. Now, one of the things that has puzzled scientists, entomologists for years is why 17 years?
Right. Why that time frame?
And how does a cicada know when 17 years is up? Because all of these cicadas are going to be emerging 17 years later. And what entomologists have determined is that they're able to count the years, essentially, by the changes in fluid flow through those tree roots. When the tree flushes and the leaves come out, they're able to detect those subtle changes in the fluid dynamics within the xylem and the roots.
So that like clicks off the thing in the brain. Oh, that's year one, right?
Well, it's not clear how they keep track. That's the question, is like,
right.
How do they ever remember that they're up to year 12, 13, or 14? But cicadas can sometimes be tricked if there's an early, in the spring, sometimes we'll get in January or February, kind of those real warm days. And in some cases, some trees may even leaf out. If that's followed by a hard frost and then the leaves then come out again in March or April, the cicadas will sometimes count that as 2 years, and cicada broods will emerge a year early in those places because they've perceive that as a two-year cycle in the matter of just a couple of months.
We're talking with Dr. Jim Fredericks. He is the chief entomologist of the National Pest Management Association. I guess, now that some of us may understand this workings of the cicadas a little bit better, one thing that for those of us who love our trees and stuff in our yards, are they damaging at all if they're eating along those roots and then they're coming up into the trees for their mating and whatever? Is this damaging to trees? Is that a misconception, or what do we tell folks about that aspect of this?
It's a great question, Dean, and pest control professionals get that question all the time. But unlike termites and cockroaches and bed bugs and ticks, cicadas are not dangerous. They don't cause any damage. So as you mentioned earlier, they don't bite, they don't sting. They typically will not cause any damage to your trees or shrubs around the yard. What you will notice is that at the end of the season, so maybe when July arrives, what we will see is in places where there were large emergencies, you'll see the ends of some tree branches will die and you'll see some leaf death at the end of
because of the eggs being laid there, right?
That's right. That's okay. Right. But the cicadas don't harm the trees. In fact, they're helpful in a way. You know, they wouldn't want to kill a tree or hurt a tree because that's got to be their food source for the next 17 years, right?
Yeah, 17-year lifeline. You don't want to break the food chain. That's right. For sure.
But by burrowing through the soil, they're actually aerating the soil, nutrients to the soil. There's going to be a lot of cicadas that will die over the next, six to eight weeks, and that will become, you know, as those decompose. Those nutrients go back into the soil. And so it's all part of the cycle. So they're not going to be damaging the plants, with the exception if you have if you just this spring maybe planted some seedlings. If cicadas lay enough eggs on those that all of the leaves die, all of the branches are affected, that could have some impact. So if you're concerned about those types of, you know, and I'm talking about young
saplings, saplings within a couple of years old.
You can cover those with some netting or something like that to keep those cicadas off for a couple of weeks.
Or pull them off if you're adventurous and want to have a little fun. They're not fun to hold. I remember as a kid, my dad made me hold one time. And of course, then it starts buzzing in your hand and you get all freaked out as a little kid. Maybe that's why I'm an amateur entomologist. Dr. Fredericks, one other thing I have noticed here in Pennsylvania where we are, an absolute overabundance of ticks this year. I think worse than I've seen in a while. I don't know if that was just a combination of wetness, temperature, and everything. But, you know, this is something that I keep warning people. I play a lot of disc golf. I know a lot of folks, you know, this is prime fishing time now. Trout season is underway and it's a lot of fly fishing and stuff. So I know a lot of friends that have been out and about and have been having problems with that. Obviously, with people out and about looking for these cicadas and kind of looking, that may be kind of a double-edged sword here where we've got a tick problem, which may lead to problems while you're trying to look at a different bug here. Is that true?
It could be. And, you know, this has been we've heard reports of lots of tick activity all along, certainly along the East Coast, in the Mid-Atlantic for sure. And as people are out and about this spring, you might be out cicada watching. You might be fly fishing. You might be doing, you know, something else out in the woods or in
gardening, getting ready.
Gardenings. Yeah, this is the time of year and there are lots of ticks that are active. And so we recommend that you definitely, wear repellent. And
do you need DEET? Do they need the higher DEET levels for those or can you go with the more safer varieties of repellents for ticks?
You know, what you ought to look for is whatever tick repellent you're using. There are a number of different active ingredients. DEET is great. Look for an EPA registration number on the repellent, because what that's going to do is that will tell you that it has gone through rigorous testing, and EPA and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has determined that it's safe for use on humans. It doesn't cause adverse effects to humans or the environment, and it's been shown to be effective as well for protecting you against ticks. So that's going to be something to look for. Look for that EPA registration number.
And then the other thing, Jim, I be diligent about checking yourself, checking your kids, checking your dog. Just anytime you're outside for any length of time. I mean, it doesn't take more than a moment for that tick to jump up on you. So make sure you're checking. And then I've been carrying one of those little, there's different names for it. I've heard it, tick twister or nipper or tick ease, that thing where you can quickly try to pull off the tick that's not, you know, just starting the burrowing process before it can get deep dislodged. And I've had a number of people that think that probably saved them because if, you know, they hadn't noticed it and gotten to it quickly, it could have been problematic.
Yeah, removing ticks in particular, people are concerned about deer ticks, the all that we call the black-legged tick. because it can transmit the pathogen that causes Lyme disease.
Right.
Removing those ticks promptly is really important. They've shown that it takes approximately 24 hours or so for that pathogen to be transmitted. So if you can find that tick and remove it quickly, that's going to be the key to one of the keys to disease prevention. We actually have at our website, which is pestworld.org, we have some videos on how to remove ticks safely.
Ooh, good stuff.
There's lots of old wives' tales and interesting home remedies for removing ticks. But really the best way is to grasp that tick, you know, typically with a pair of tweezers or forceps right behind its head, and then steady pressure. Don't yank, steady pressure, and that tick will let go. Because their mouth parts have these barbs, like fishhook barbs, that hold them into your skin.
They don't want to leave once they get in.
They don't want to fall off. The feeding process takes a couple of days in most cases. But if you yank it, you can, you know, remove its head, and its head stays lodged in your skin. But if steady pressure, and the tick does not want its head to come off,
right?
And they will just let go and then pull out. So.
Interesting stuff. So again, recapping, we're probably now, we've been seeing the signs. I've been using, have you seen the Cicada Safari? It's an app where you can report your cicada emergence, take pictures, and then because in this Brood X, I read there's four different species that happen to just be in this same cycle. So I guess there's like 3,000 species of cicadas. Who knew? But here we go. 6 to 8 weeks of cicada fun, Dr. Jim Fredericks. It's going to be interesting. Thanks for joining us. Great information here on Everything Under the Sun.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, that website that Jim mentioned, and it is a treasure trove of information. It's pestworld.org, pestworld.org. You can actually find a biography of Jim in there and all those great information, tick prevention tips, things about West Nile virus and EEE and all the other things. And there's a subsection right out the top there, Brood X cicadas. Another great article I found, the Scientific American article about this that just came out in the last couple of weeks, very helpful as well. And we've got all kinds of information about this on AccuWeather.com. So we'll be following the story as it continues to creep through the next several weeks. I know I had to get another one of those in. What we are getting in next is an interview with our friend, Dr. Liz Bentley from ArMets. Yes, the Weather Photographer of the Year contest for 2021 continues about halfway through the submission period. We'll check in with Liz about how that's going, get you information about the contest and more. That's coming up next. This is episode 9 of our spring series of Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com.
Listen to Weather Insider every weekday for a discussion on trending weather news. You'll get detailed insight into major weather events and learn the why behind the weather. Just subscribe to Weather Insider on your favorite podcast platforms today.
Welcome back to Everything Under the Sun here from AccuWeather.com. I'm your host, meteorologist Dean DeVore. We are so proud to be partnering once again with the Royal Meteorological Society for the 2021 Royal Meteorological Society Weather Photographer of the Year contest. Third time we've partnered with those great folks, and it's Chief Executive of ArMets, Dr. Liz Bentley, joins me to talk about where we are as we get ready to go from spring into summer and get ready to view all these great submissions. Liz, welcome back. First of all, you know, we were talking before we got on the air here, and we're both lamenting how chilly it is here in the month of May. As you know, we talked about this with Paul Pastelak last week and Everything Under the Sun. There was actually another little sudden stratospheric warming event that came mid to late April, and it's plunged some cold air down. Here in the Northeast in the Great Lakes, we had some snow and some cold temperatures. And I know you were telling me that probably one of the chilliest mid to late springs that you can remember in England and Great Britain.
Yeah, in England and also across most of Europe, if I'm honest, very low temperatures. And just looking at April, the month of April in the UK, so we saw one of the coldest Aprils on record, particularly if you look at overnight temperatures, the minimum temperatures. So way down, 3 degrees below where the average is. And that was partly due to this northerly blast, so an Arctic blast. But we had high pressure that dominated. And clear skies at night, we lost that blanket of cloud, so really good radiation nights. So those temperatures were really dropping away overnight. And then we went into May, similar conditions. We've had snow across certainly the northern half of the UK, not just at high levels over the highlands of Scotland, but down to lower levels. We had a football match here in the UK in Manchester. Manchester City were playing and they had snow on the ground.
Yeah, I watched that. Yeah, I'm a Man City. I'm a blue moon all the way, girl.
so again, you know, to see snow in the center of Manchester in a city, you know, in May was
especially
quite
when you guys don't get snow that often in the winter. So I mean, it's just a little reversal of fortune here. So, well, at least it makes opportunities for people to take interesting weather photos, right, when they're getting out of season stuff. So that's why we're here. We're talking with Dr. Liz Bentley from RMETS here and getting an update on the Weather Photographer of the Year competition for 2021, which AccuWeather is proud to be a supporter of and sponsor of. And the submission time is open, Liz, and you've got some results of already people streaming images into you guys, right?
Yeah, so the competition opened on the 29th of April, so we've been open just over 10 days or so now, and we've already had 1,700 entries from nearly 700 photographers right around the world. And some of those images we're sharing on social media, so if you're a Twitter follower or Facebook follower of RMETS, you'll see some of those images that we're showcasing. We're also doing a little bit of a deep dive into some past images. So looking at some of the images focusing on rainfall or droughts and having a bit of an explainer around, you know, what causes droughts and, you know, why we get rain and those kind of things.
So that's cool. So you're taking past images and then you're kind of taking it and using it as a teaching opportunity.
Right. So to just educate people about the different weather phenomena that we've, you know, seen in a lot of these photographs. So again, at the RMETS website, rmets.org, you can have a look at a lot of the images, both from this competition, but also, as I say, from some of the previous competitions with some explainers as well.
How much more time do people have to get their entries in now? Are we getting close to the deadline?
So the competition stays open until the 29th of June. So there's still a good month and a half really to go before we close. Then there's another opportunity later in the year. So we'll do the judging in July and we'll shortlist the images and share them. And then we go into a public vote. So there's another opportunity at the end of August into September for people to engage with the competition again. But if people want to submit an image for this year, then they've got until the 29th of June.
Okay, so about from when this drops here mid-May, about another 5 or 6 weeks. And again, we let people know, I think sometimes people think, well, I have to take a picture in that period, right? I have to take it there at the beginning of the year. But no, we're accepting pictures from the past. How far back can you go to submit an image from a past weather event?
Yeah, so I mean, typically we'd be looking for something that's been taken in the last 12 months, and that's what we'd like to see. But, you know, we will get some images going a little bit further back than that as well. But, you know, so it doesn't have to be during this period when the competition's open. So maybe something that's been taken during 2020 into 2021 are really the kind of images that we're looking for. So you can pick things from different seasons, which is really what we're looking for. Obviously, as you say, it's been cold with you and cold with us even into this spring. And we've obviously got the winter season where we saw lots of snow. So we expect to get some good winter images coming in. But even from last year, to get some images from autumn, you know, the beautiful kind of colors we get in autumn would be really good to see some of those as well.
Again, so you have till the end of June to submit your photograph. And again, we also have different divisions. We have the General Weather Photographer of the Year competition. And then we also have a separate grouping for youngsters, right? We kind of highlight the work of folks 18 and under.
Yeah, that's right. So we've been running these two categories now for a few years. So the Young Weather Photographer of the Year is for ages 13 to 17, and then the General Weather Photographer of the Year for kind of 18 and over. But we've introduced a third category this year. So we have had in the past a number of images that you clearly have come from smartphones and mobile phones, you know, fantastic quality images. But We have also recognised that I think people have been a little bit reluctant to enter a weather competition by sending in a photo that they took on their mobile phone. So we've opened a separate category for mobile phone images only, and hoping to encourage a lot more people, because there are some great photos taken just on a phone. You don't need a professional camera to take images.
Have you seen that split in the entry so far? Have you seen the results that you were hoping to by adding that new category?
Absolutely so. So the 1,700 entries that I referred to that we've had so far split across all three of those categories. So it's great to see that, you know, we're getting entries coming in for all three of them.
Dr. Liz Bentley with the Royal Meteorological Society, again, teaming here with AccuWeather, second year in a row now and third time overall with the Royal Meteorological Society Weather Photographer of the Year contest. Again, we'll submit till the end of June. We'll take some time. You, Jesse Farrell from AccuWeather, and the other judges will take a look, and then we'll have a list where we as the public, once we get later on in the summer, early fall, we as the public can do a little judging. It's kind of a separate kind of judging than you will do for the competition itself. But I think it's kind of interesting to see what you all like. We saw this last year, and then what the public likes. And it's not always the same thing, right? So the public likes some things that maybe the actual judges didn't see the first time, or didn't maybe appreciate like the public does.
Yeah, so this will be the sixth year we've run this competition, and we've run a public vote every year, and we've never had the public vote being the same as the overall winner. Right. So it's great. And you know, people have a very different, people look for different things in these images. So that's perfectly fine. And it means that we've got more winners of, you know, the different categories. So that's great as well.
All right. So anything going on out there over there in Europe, weather-wise, news-wise, that you might want to catch us up on, Liz, other than this unseasonably chilly spring here? Anything else? I know last time we were on, we talked about some of the, you know, it's been several months now since the European folks went to a free situation with their modeling data and stuff. Maybe just catch us up what you think that result has been here in the last several months since that occurred. Have you seen something tangible from that that's been positive?
Yeah, so I haven't seen any verification statistics to kind of back it up, but definitely some anecdotal experiences of people seeing an improvement there. I think the other big news to mention, which was announced maybe a week or so ago now, is the Met Office are partnering with Microsoft to develop their new supercomputer. And that will be a fundamental step change in the quality of forecasts, both for weather forecasts, but for the climate model forecasts as well. So the kind of predictions that go out, you know, a century into the future. And that will be a huge step change for them. So a massive partnership for the Met Office. And I think they're really excited about you know, how that's going to develop. And that starts pretty much immediately in the next few months. So it's a project that will probably span 2 years, but we'll get going in a few months' time. And then you'll slowly see this new kind of supercomputer suite appear to replace the old system.
In case folks aren't aware, the Met Office, or the UK Met, is the equivalent in the National Weather Service here in our country. And Royal Meteorological Society is kind of equivalent to the American Meteorological Society. So it's a group that's based on education and trying to teach and help the professional meteorologists, you know, enhance their lives and enhance their profession. So, I'm sure that sounds exciting, too. How about, you know, just kind of your thoughts about folks in Great Britain and getting ready to come out of the pandemic, come out of the spring and get ready to go for summer? Do you kind of feel that kind of push going on now where people are getting vaccinated and getting ready to chomping at the bit to get out there and enjoy the summer?
Yes, absolutely. So when we went into our first lockdown last March 2020, the weather here was beautiful. You know, it was blue skies, temperatures well above average. We certainly haven't had that this spring. So, and I think people are just optimistic as we come out of our lockdown. So we've got another deadline next Monday, the 17th of May, and then the June the 21st is when we hopefully come fully out of lockdown. And I think people are hoping the summer will treat us to something special here in the UK. for us, I guess as an organization, we start to think about getting back into work. So we've been home working now for 16 months. But I don't know what it's like in the US. Organizations like ourselves and, you know, even companies that we partner with are considering about the new norm for working. So, you know, I think we'll end up with a blended approach of people working from home some of the time and in the office some of the time.
I think it depends. I know we're here at AccuWeather kind of aiming for about middle of June to get back most of our people. I really think it depends on the position. I mean, if or the job tactic that you need. Yeah. I mean, I find in-person collaboration sometimes better in meteorology than the time that it takes to do things over Zoom and stuff. But that's just me personally. Obviously, I think there are advantages both ways. But yeah, it'll be very interesting to see how this transforms things. So again, till the end of June, June 29th, right? That's the deadline for submission.
Yep, plenty of time. If you log on to the website, so you can get that via the Royal Met Society's website, rmets.org, and yeah, straight through and upload. You can upload 5 photographs per photographer.
If you'd like more information about the contest, go to the website rmets.org, or come to AccuWeather.com and search Weather Photographer of the Year. You'll find information. You can follow Liz on Twitter. Her Twitter handle is DrLizBentley, Dr. Liz Bentley, Bentley. From the Weather Photographer of the Year contest to our weather for the next few days. Bill Dagher is up next with me as we talk about the weather for this upcoming weekend and the week beyond. This is Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com.
This podcast is sponsored by NHTSA. Every year, children die from being left alone in cars. If you see a child left unattended, call 911 immediately.
Welcome back to Everything Under the Sun with meteorologist Dean DeVore, your host here as we continue on in our spring series and our focus of this segment, the cicadas. Great to talk about that here in the last segment. Rewind it if you want to learn as much as you can. I've been bugging Bill Dagher to come back on the show with us here in this final segment. Yes, to do our normal weather for this upcoming week and week beyond. And, you know, I went away for a week. I was out away from the office last week, wasn't doing my normal stuff. Still did the podcast from Columbus, Ohio, and did that while I was doing some other things with the NCAA volleyball championship. But, you know, while I went away, the weather really went downhill in the Great Lakes in the Northeast for about a week. I feel like I'm slowly building it back, Bill, here to some nice stuff. But, you know, typical springtime challenges here in this upcoming forecast. And certainly in the week ahead, some interesting weather to come. But wow, what a stretch of weather there for a week or so. And now, I talked to Paul Pasluck last week. There was another little stratospheric sudden warm up that kind of pushed another pretty big batch of cold air down. It seemed like a monthly occurrence the last few months. We get about a week of that, and it was centered on the Great Lakes and even spilled over into the Northeast. But it feels like things are trying to get back to normal in some of those areas here as we go into this upcoming weekend.
Yeah, the most severe example of that sudden stratospheric warming event, of course, back in February there when Texas dealt with that severe outbreak of cold weather. Of course, we had a bunch of winter storms impacting the East. Of course, now we're into May, so it's going to be a little bit of a different flavor when you have those events. And boy, you're right, 10 to 20 degrees below normal the past week to week and a half across the Midwest and Northeast. But starting to see that light at the end of the tunnel. At least we got to get back to normal here the next few days, and then maybe we can talk about going above normal after that by next week.
And, you know, it seemed to me that one of the things about this one locked in a little bit longer. Some of those other, the one in February, it was deep and it was bad, but then it just kind of rebounded again. And then we got another one, I think, in March, but this one hung on a little bit. And I think we're going to see, you know, some of the residual effects of that, especially as we go into the weekend. I mean, we're all hankering for great weather. I know as we record this Thursday into Friday, we've had a couple of rebound days here, but we're still dealing with and a process that we're familiar with this time of year. Sometimes it's just frustrating because we'd like it to be better the whole day, but we start out with some nice sunshine, but then it self-destructs into clouds that can produce a shower, make the afternoon not so nice for a while, but then it looks like once the energy of the day and the heating of the day goes away, those clouds go back to mainly clear skies. And we're going to see that at times. It's going to be kind of a pick your spots where that's occurring as we go through this weekend.
Yeah, it's going to be a gradual warm up in the Northeast, especially when we're talking about temperatures aloft. If it's very cold in the upper levels of the atmosphere on these days with sunshine, that's what gives you the cumulus clouds, the sprinkles and showers. We have a couple more days of that to contend with into the weekend. But then after that, I think it's not so much the temperatures delivering the clouds and showers, but little waves of low pressure that are riding from the Midwest to the Northeast. It's what we call a split flow in the jet stream. So it's going to warm up, but it's not, you know, where the jet streams well to our north and we're dry. We're going to have these showers and storms come through with the warmer weather.
Yeah. Let's talk about that when we get to next week. For the weekend, though, I do want to, there is one area I think we need to highlight, and we've been talking about that in the office a lot. It's that area in the middle of the country where there seems to be a battleground between the chilliest air and then that warmer air trying to push up. And so I think there's going to be some real rounds of heavy rain, showers and thunderstorms, central plains. You know, you're talking about states like Nebraska, down into Kansas and over into Missouri and up into southern parts of Iowa and even over into central Illinois as we go through the weekend. Could be some areas there that pick up multiple rounds of showers and thunderstorms that could cause some localized flooding. You know, it's been fairly dry in some of those areas here the last couple of weeks, Bill. So it's kind of catch 22. It's bad timing in some of those areas, but some of this is needed. Doesn't think it creates many major flooding problems, but some issues, no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the time of year you want the rain, especially in the plains. And you're right. The first round of rain and thunderstorms gets going probably later Friday into Saturday morning. We'll have multiple rounds then later Saturday into Sunday, like you said, Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri, Iowa. And then by the time we get to next week, toward the middle of next week, the focus shifts a little further south into the southern plains and the Mississippi Valley. Yeah, it's not looking like a classic setup for severe weather. We'll have a few severe storms there every couple of days and the threat of you know, these heavy storms bringing a couple of inches of rain. But you're right. This is the time of year they could use that rain.
One other area that may see some showers is out west. There's a kind of a little dip in this weekend jet stream that'll bring some cooler air, but maybe some showers, mountains in California and in Nevada. Looks dry and pretty nice up in the Pacific Northwest, actually a little warmer than average in the northern plains. Let's get into early next week, and I do want to talk about that. Now, in the winter, we see pretty much one jet stream over us here in the lower 48. Dividing the really cold air from the warmer air. So we get into this time of year, as Bill alluded to earlier, the jet stream actually splits. So you've got the real cold air still locked in Canada. You got a kind of a moderate zone, but even that's going to get a little warm here early next week, all the way, you know, over the top of that moderate zone. New York, if you go back through the northern plains and the northern parts of the Pacific Northwest are going to be pretty warm. Then there's a secondary jet that's coming through California, kind of undulates through the central plains in the southeast, and that's going to bring some showers and thunderstorms continuing. That stuff that we're seeing over the weekend starts kind of slowly pushing eastward, but it looks like some wet patterns, some repeated progressive showers and thunderstorms there in the middle of the country, and then spreading into the Ohio Valley here as we get into the first part of next week.
Yeah, and the big thing is that with the two jet streams, that northern branch of the jet stream is lifting north. That's where you want to be if you want to see the warmer temperatures. You at least want that northern branch to be to your north. But yeah, the southern branch will definitely be coming into play here across, you know, really much of the lower 48. An area of high pressure at the surface along the eastern seaboard will try to keep that rain and thunder off to the west, but it eventually gives in the mid-Atlantic by the time you get to Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and even beyond, rounds of rain and thunder moving through. Now, computer models have been, you know, going back and forth, some north, some further south with each successive run. So hard to pinpoint exactly where that heavy rain corridor will be, but right now I kind of peg it right from the Central Plains into the Ohio Valley and the southern mid-Atlantic here from the weekend into early next week.
So things that you'll need to consider now over the next several days and keep you up to date with all these forecasted details on your AccuWeather.com app and with our AccuWeather network. You know, we've been talking cicadas and, you know, so the meteorological kind of tie-ins here is this emergence is really based on the areas where soil temperatures are getting up to around 54 degrees or so. And then, as Jim talked about in that last segment, it seems like a nice warm rain can precede that. I gave Bill the Cicada Safari app. Bill's our resident Twitter guy and app guy and kind of likes information flow. So I was looking at the map here as we record this on Friday. We're starting to see emergence now coming up the I-99 corridor here in Pennsylvania, Bill. Looks like most of the emergence has been down through the mid-Atlantic states and out in parts of the Midwest. And I had some folks tell me when I was out in Ohio yesterday that they were getting into that. So looks like the emergence is on the move north and east. It's going to be interesting to see that here over the next couple of weeks and hear it, I guess, is the most thing that we'll be doing with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of like tracking earlier in the spring. We watched, you know, that map that shows where leaves are currently right on trees. And
yep,
it's fun to see that advance north. So I guess it's kind of like the cicadas here. And right, I have a friend who's on TV in the Harrisburg market, and he's been all over the cicada, you know, phenomenon. And he pointed out that J-Lo and Ben Affleck last were together 17 years ago. And they're together again now, apparently. So a connection, perhaps?
Maybe. This is my third go around with this brood X. And you know, I had a couple of people say, well, you know, it seems like they say it's the 17-year cicadas every few years. And that's because there's multiple broods. I think there's 12 different broods. And then those areas can overlap. We're in the northern part of the lower 48, 17-year cycles. There's some of these cyclical cicadas that are 13-year-old cycles, the 13-year cycles that are born in the South. So, yeah, lots to learn, and it's going to be interesting. I love it. I think it's the soundtrack of summer, hearing cicadas. Now we're going to get it all summer long. Bill, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thank you.
Wow, that wraps up a busy Episode 9 here in the spring series of Everything Under the Sun. Thanks again to Dr. Jim Fredericks. So much great information about cicadas. We'll keep you up to date on that. Probably have some updates here on the show as we go through the next few months and also on AccuWeather.com. Also, thanks to Dr. Liz Bentley from RMETS as we continue to get ready for the Weather Photographer of the Year as the conversation and competition progresses. We'll keep you up to date on that. And Bill Dagher will certainly be heard on WBBM in Chicago on weekends, other great radio stations across the country from our AccuWeather service, and you'll read them on AccuWeather.com as well. Friends, that'll do it. Episode 10 next week, we're going to talk about something that we've been reading about here meteorologically in the last couple of months. It looks like from the research is the lightning capital of America is shifted. It used to be Florida, the most lightning strikes and problems with fatalities, but it looks like those numbers are shifted to another state. Where is that? We'll tell you next week. We'll also do some more checking on late spring and early summer stuff as we continue to roll on as the meteorological spring dwindles into the second half of this month of May. For all of us from AccuWeather, all our great team members across the world, and for my executive producers, Ken Prell and Andrew Robb, have a great week. I'm meteorologist Dean DeVore. Thanks for listening. This is Everything Under the Sun from AccuWeather.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. Be sure to subscribe to, rate, and review Everything Under the Sun on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. And of course, if you have an idea for a future podcast, just email us at accuweather.podcast@accuweather.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.